Session number 7304, reel 1.
Colonel King, reel 1.
Colonel, can I ask you first why you decided to join the army?
Well, my father was in the Indian Medical Service, which meant that during his period of service, especially as a junior officer, he had to serve with and be medical officer to Indian Army troops. Later on, of course, he turned and he became on the civil side, and he finished up by being in charge of various hospitals and being consultant surgeon, etc., etc. When I started growing up, 14, 15, he thought he'd like me to be a doctor. Neither of my brothers wanted to be. Unfortunately, I didn't want to be. The thought of it really filled me with a certain amount of gloom. But I always was interested in the services, and I thought I'd like to go into the services. And so it was a question of, if I did go to Sandhurst, what I should do. Should I go to the Indian Army, or should I go to the British Army? My father was not keen that I should serve under perhaps an Indian commanding officer, and he wanted me to go into the British Army. My brother had gone into the Indian Army, so that was another reason he wanted me to go into the British Army. I went, the question of what I should go to. I never wanted to be a gunner. I wanted to be an infantryman or an armoured corps person. The Royal Tanks, it was difficult to get into then, and I didn't have, in those days, you need a bit of money if you want to be a cavalryman, and there was not that sort of money available. So it meant really, if I wanted to go to infantry, I had to make a choice of who it should be. Now, I lived in Devon, I was brought up in Devon, my father retired, but I was born in Sussex. And so the Devons were fairly oversubscribed. Promotion was bad in those days, you know? And so I thought it might be better in the Royal Sussex. So from Sandhurst, I went into the Royal Sussex.
Very complex set of reasons for ending up in the Royal Sussex.
Yes, it was.
Now, can I ask you about your expectations of war in the 1930s? When did you first think that a war was likely?
I think, really, it was when we were pretty sure there was going to be a war, when we saw the Italian troop ships going through the Suez Canal for the Abyssinian War.
That was in 1935.
Which I think was 1935. And we used to, we had the greatest difficulty in preventing our troops making very rude gestures from the canal banks to these Italian ships going through with these Italian soldiers on board.
Did the Italian soldiers make any gestures to your troops?
Well, they thought that the British soldier was sort of waving at them, but in actual fact they were pulling the plug, putting their hand up and then pulling their hand down.
To flush the Italians away.
Exactly, and making a rude noise.
But they waved back, did they, the Italians?
Well, they did. They did, until they realised, I think until the penny dropped, put it that way.
So from then on, you thought a war was likely. When did you think that a war was inevitable?
I'm sure it was before the before Chamberlain went off to see Hitler.
Can you remember if there was anything, any specific event which raised your expectations of war?
Well, I think it was that the Chamberlain, when he came back waving a bit of paper saying he'd Hitler had agreed there should be peace and etc., etc. I mean, we frankly didn't believe it.
You thought it was just a stay of execution?
Exactly. Because it was during that. I had been back to England on 3 weeks' leave, actually, across France. And I had got stuck during that Munich crisis, they called it, yes. I got stuck in France because the ship I was coming back on had been requisitioned by the French, a Messagerie maritime boat, to send their people who were on leave in France back to Algeria and other places where the French were. And we had to find another boat, just like that. And when we arrived back, I mean, there was virtually, we had a vehicle waiting for us, which was the second lieutenant in the middle of in Alexandria. It was quite extraordinary. We were told to get back to our unit as quick as possible.
And presumably, as the war approached, you had conceived of Italy as being an enemy.
Oh, yes. No doubt about it at all. And we actually mobilised. We were stationed in Moasca, which was Ismailia, that area. And our actual mobilisation station was Suez. And I think it was the 20th of August that we actually mobilised.
In 1939. If you expected Italy to be an enemy, what did you think the Italians would actually do?
Well, we thought, first of all, that they'd invade Egypt eventually.
But that would be from Libya, right?
Well, yes, from Libya. Because, quite frankly, I mean, they had a predominance of force there compared to what the British had in Merzimetru and in Cairo.
Did you think they might attempt any enterprise from Ethiopia?
At that time, I don't think I did personally, no, because I think one's mind was very much more on Egypt and I never dreamt I'd even, you know, sort of finish up in the Sudan or Eritrea.
Because the threat was much more immediate.
Indeed, much more immediate, because there was nothing to stop, really. Well, put it this way, very little to stop the Italians coming from the west across the desert into Merzimetru and into Alexandria.
What did the process of mobilisation entail?
Well, I knew it pretty well intimately because the adjutant went on leave just after I came back and I was made adjutant, acting adjutant. And so the whole of the mobilisation from the headquarters point of view and the orders being given emanate from the CO through me. And it all happened as usual in the early hours of the morning. And one had in those days, one's companies were there and they had a minimum of transport and a minimum of various types of kit. The rest was in a mobilisation store which was part within the battalion lines. And the first thing one had to do was to get... We had the instructions, which were already out with the companies, opened up, and the company commanders then the quartermaster got out the opened up the mobilisation stores, and out came the additional vehicles and various other things like that. And the whole thing took... You had a complete sort of programme, a plan, timed plan, as to what you should do from what you might call HR, that being the hour in which mobilisation started, right the way through for the next 18 hours, 24 hours. And by that time, I mean within that period of time, one started moving as a battalion down to Suez, which was our mobilisation station.
So the administration took about 18 hours.
I should think so. It could have been done in less. I'm sure of it. But during that period of time, one had to send an advance party off down to Suez in order to jack up and find places to accommodate some of the troops.
What was your own role as adjutant while the mobilisation was actually taking place?
To see, mainly, for the commanding officer, to see that everything was going as per timetable.
So, would it be fair to say that you had to coordinate the various stages.
Indeed, yes.
And to go and sort out any specific difficulties.
That's right. And to see that the various things that were being attached to us were things. Because normally we were in a, what one might call, a garrison. And so one didn't have one's medical staff within the battalion. It was all part of a medical centre there. And you had to hook out your doctor and your people like that to be in with you in the battalion then.
Did you have to have additional drivers as well, that sort of thing?
They had unfortunately all been trained previously, although they didn't have the vehicles, because they were in a mobilisation store.
Did the mobilisation go smoothly?
It did. It did. That went quite smoothly. It was the question of the other end didn't go smoothly, because one was dealing in certain places where we were supposed to be accommodated, certain companies, were in, for example, Port Tewfik docks. Well, Port Tewfik docks in a custom shed there. Well, of course, I mean, it was loaded up with God knows what. And in came a company there, picking to lie down and sleep the night and set up a cookhouse and things like that, and there wasn't a room, so all that had to be cleared out. Those sort of things, there was naturally delayed us a bit. But we got down to the task that we had to do, which was really at that time, for that time, was internal security and protection of the southern end of the canal.
Now, this would seem to show that there was a sort of battalion war book which had been worked out in advance and presumably had been practiced by exercise, so the problems could be ironed out.
Yes, that's true.
But there wasn't a comparable war book for the civilian administration.
No. Well, there was, and you went quite well when one dealt with it, put it this way, the refineries, because that was run by Anglo-Iranian and Shell. Now, they knew a company was going to be billeted in the refineries. They'd known, well, they all didn't know, but the manager of Shell and the manager of the refineries knew that there was. And in consequence of that, they had this, they said, okay, and they had already previously allotted accommodation, etc., etc. And also the whole of the security side had been worked out with them. And so that went well. But when you came to dealing with the Egyptian government, it was a very different matter.
Now, you mentioned specifically that you had to occupy a customs shed.
Mm.
What did the customs officials do about that? How did they respond to your arrival?
I think they were a bit flabbergasted. They didn't really know. I mean, they were just told to squeeze up.
These were native officials,
right? They were Egyptians. Egyptian officials there. Fortunately, we were helped by British policemen there, in the Egyptian police. They were not police. The chief of police was there, was British, down there at Suez. I think his name was White Pasha. And he had two, what you might call, sergeant major types there. Now, they were both up in the docks at Port Tewfik, where battalion headquarters was going to be and headquarter company was going to be. And I think a platoon of one of the other companies. There was another company going to be down in refineries. There was another company going to be down in Suez itself in an evacuated girls' school. And really, I mean, these two police chaps were a tremendous help to us. Because being British, first of all, there was no language problem, and they rustled up policemen, and goodness knows what, and gave policemen orders to clear things out of the way and so on. And they were a great help.
So, in your duties, presumably you maintained a close working relationship with the police.
We did. One of our main problems was communications. The Egyptian telephone system is just about the oldest in the world. I believe it still is. And, I mean, we needed extra telephone lines so we could speak to our, the brigade headquarters, which was still in Moasca, Ismailia. We needed to, if possible, to speak to our companies. And although the signals, our own battalion signals, and also the Royal Corps signals did their level best to be able to speak to our companies and refineries. The refineries, if you see, the company in the refineries was by road, something in the region of about 6 miles away. It was right down the Gulf. And so it was quite a job. You couldn't sort of lay line to them, because if it were going along, you had to go over the causeway into Suez and things like that. It really was quite out of the question. So you had to rely on Egyptian telegraph and telephones. And that was our biggest problem.
What sort of operations did you conduct in your internal security role?
Two types. One was prevention of sabotage or anything like that on the refineries. On the shell, on the refineries, which was absolutely vital. Because, in actual fact, when I say refineries, I mean refineries, because there were two. There was the Anglo-Iranian, bleak shell refineries there, and then there was next door to it, was a little one, small refinery, called the government refinery. Now, we didn't have any responsibility for the government refinery, except in so far as if the police called upon us to give assistance because they were virtually somebody was trying to blow them up or something like that. But we had no responsibility because they had their own police on it, they had their own security people on it, and they also had some Egyptian army people who used to float around the refinery there. So, and except in extreme cases, we had no responsibility. That was the first thing, refineries. The second was, it was the canal at Port Tewfikent. The Navy had established, you see, the examination vessels. And we had to supply for the Navy when an examination officer went on a ship coming up the Gulf, into the Gulf of Suez, and then wanting to go up the canal, our foreign ship, Italian ship, if you like, for some time, you see, it was still the Italian ship still until shortly. Put it this way, when we first mobilized, the war hadn't been declared, and the Italian ship was going. So we had this business there of even going on Italian ship and seeing what's on board. And we had to supply an escort to the naval officer, the examination officer. So that's that. We also, there were coast guns there. Now, these were great, big, massive, I can't remember what inch they were, but they were pretty solid, large, coastal thing, of the Royal Artillery.
Garrison Artillery.
Garrison Artillery, quite right. And there was a major there, and he was based with us, but he had guns on the Port Tewfik side, that is on the west side, and also guns on the east side. And also there was a searchlight. There was a searchlight battery. And now we had to protection for the close protection, virtually, of that battery. Then we had a reserve down in Suez, this company down in Suez down there, which was stationed in this school, which we're doing internal security duties on Suez. Rarely, it was up the Suez Road, the Suez-Cairo Road. And also, as I say, it was reserve. It was also on the ferry crossings that went over to the Palestine side. That's the Suez one, not the Kantara ferry, the Suez ferry, which went over to the Sinai side. So those were the sort of things. Lots, hell of a lot of guard duties. The other thing was that down in Suez there was a vast coal storage place, plants, which were created there. And I don't know whether they were originally service ones or whether they were civilian ones. But anyway, we had to guard those.
These were food storage areas.
Food storage, yes. And, you know, this was the sort of thing one had to do. I can't remember all the things.
When you were protecting these vulnerable vital points, did you do it mainly by static guards or by mobile patrols?
The refinery had to be done by mobile patrols. The area was too great. They did their own on the gates, virtually. They had their own sort of security people on the gates. And who were just Egyptians, but employed by the refinery. We did mobile patrols. And we went also mobile patrols right down the Gulf south. There was talk at one time that we should protection to the oil fields that were down there. There was two Egyptian oil fields down there, Ras Gharib and Hagada. When I say Egyptian, they were on the Egyptian side, and they were owned by, I think, they were Anglo-Iranian. The staff, all the executives, I think, were British or European, and of course, a lot of the others were just ordinary. The engineers, not the engineers, were Egyptian. But we didn't do it because, honestly, it was too far away.
Did you encounter any attempts at sabotage during this period of duty?
No. One had no sabotage at all that was directly associated with what might turn the enemy. Italian, German, whatever you like. No. One had sabotage done by locals, which we put down as sabotage as mainly, I think, thieving. People out to pinch copper cable and out to do things like that. But nobody tried to blow up the refineries. Nobody tried to sink a ship in Port Tufik Harbour or anything like that.
No sign of any sympathy with the enemy?
No. We had an awful flap one day, terrible flap one day, because the examination vessel had communication to the ships coming up to the Gulf and used to ask for their identification, which they usually got. One day, I think it was Sunday too, a ship came up, was asked to identify itself, didn't. Was told to stop, didn't. Went on banging up past the examination vessel. The Navy chap in charge there got in touch with battalion headquarters. Battalion headquarters got in touch with the guns. The guns sprang into it. Ship still came on. Ship was told, flashed and told to stop, and didn't stop. So the guns opened up. And that created quite a scene, because the guns didn't actually, I think, aim for the ship.
Aimed across the bows, presumably.
Across the bows. But unfortunately, hit another ship. A perfectly innocent ship. And this created quite a scene. But in the meanwhile, as I say, this had happened. And all it was, this was a Greek ship coming up with a Greek skipper aboard there who'd had one whine of a lunch party, obviously. It was absolutely drunk as a newt and was sound asleep. And there was nobody on watch at all.
What happened to him? Was he arrested?
Oh, yes, he was arrested. That ship didn't move for days up the canal.
Assumably he was charged with negligent navigation.
That's right, because everybody had been told, you see, it's part of the international, I don't know, I suppose the international thing there, to stop when you ought to do so, going up the canal. One had a lot of liaison that time, of course, with the Suez Canal Company, you see.
Did you have contact with civil management of the refineries as well?
Yes, knew them very well indeed, very much so. They were extremely helpful. They were very, very good to the soldiers down there.
Was there any formal machinery for the liaison, or was it all done on an ad hoc basis?
There was a formal machinery. It had been agreed beforehand. Oh, yes, there was. But, I mean, anything that suddenly cropped up, was dealt with on the spot, usually with the company commander down there. And if he couldn't, then he had to he referred to the town headquarters. And I, as acting agent, or as even CO, would go down and see what was the trouble and try and sort it out. But in actual fact, gone very well with them indeed.
What about contact with the Egyptian civil authorities? Was that on a similar basis?
That was not so easy. That was not so easy. You had a mayor. I suppose he was called a mayor. I can't remember what he was called. Sort of head chap. No, he wasn't. He was the governor. He was called the governor of Suez. That's right. And he was the head chap there. Well, he was just, to a large extent, rather in a sort of mayoral role there, with his civil servants underneath him. It was desperately slow to try and get anything done. They would be cooperative. The senior ones would be cooperative. No use dealing with a junior one at all. You had to go to the senior one. Sometimes he wouldn't, and he'd kick it around, and it was too frightened to go and see the governor about it. So one had problems. Sometimes you had to do it in a triangular fashion. You had to go to the Suez Canal Company head office there, see the head man there, who, powerful chap, and he would do it through the mayor, and he would get it done much quicker that way than going direct.
Was there any hint of anti-British or nationalist feeling from the civil population? Did you, for instance,
no.
consider having to deal with demonstrations or disorders?
No, there was none. I suppose there were one or two people in the government. Put it this way, the civil service who were slightly resented the fact that we were there. But we had no direct hostility. We had from the local people. I think they were only too pleased to make a little money out of the soldiery there.
How did the soldiers get on with the local population? Did they?
Well, we had very strict. We were very, very strict with the soldiers, and virtually where they were allowed to go, very firmly laid down. Where they could go and swim, where they could go and what cafes they could use, were very, very strictly allowed. And, of course, no soldier was allowed out after 9 o'clock at night. None. Sergeants and above were. They were limited out to midnight. But, I mean, otherwise, they're not. They were not allowed out a soldier after that time, except on duty.
Was this for their own safety, or was it for incidents?
I think it was to prevent incidents more than anything else. Prevent incidents.
You mentioned the Egyptian police force. Were they armed?
Yes, partly. Armed with... They carried... Once on what you might call...